Tehran and Muscat signed several documents to boost cooperation as the Sultan of Oman pays a two-day state visit to Iran. The Turkish president calls for unity and solidarity after winning the country's runoff vote, saying Turkey and democracy are winners of the election. Also coming up, Syria's air defenses shoot down Israeli missiles as the regime launches a fresh airstrike on the country's capital, Damascus. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the Sultan of Oman and the Iranian president have held talks on a range of issues in a bid to further enhance mutual relations. The negotiations followed an official welcoming ceremony in Tehran, where visiting Haytham bin Tariq was formally received by Ibrahim Raisi. The Omani head of state is leading a high-ranking delegation. The trip is aimed at enhancing cooperation and bilateral relations in different areas. Following the negotiations between the two leaders, the Iranian and Omani foreign ministers held a joint press conference where they briefed reporters on the agreements reached by the two sides.
The documents, which focus on cooperation in the fields of energy, investment, free zones, as well as in the areas of industry. We both agree that a document called Comprehensive Strategic Cooperation between the two countries should be signed between the two sides in the near future.
Iran's foreign minister added that other issues were also discussed by the two leaders, namely the transit of goods, the Ashgabat agreement, as well as a quadrilateral transit deal between Iran, Oman, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. He said closer cooperation among regional countries was also emphasized during the talks between the two leaders. The Omani foreign minister, in turn, noted that the two sides reached good agreements in a bid to further enhance their age-old relations. Iran and Oman have maintained cordial ties throughout the years and have recently stepped up efforts to strengthen their partnership. The head of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting, Peyman Jabili, has met with Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah on his visit to Lebanon. During the talks, Jabili and Nasrallah discussed the responsibilities of the media affiliated with the resistance front, the challenges they face, and how to deal with them. Nasrallah stressed that the resistance media play a major role in confronting Israeli occupation and the West's hegemonic policies. Earlier, Jabili also met with the Speaker of the Lebanese Parliament as well as the country's culture minister. He has stressed the IRIB's readiness to help improve cultural ties between Iran and Lebanon. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan remains in office for another 5 years as he wins Sunday's runoff vote with over 99% of ballot boxes counted. Erdogan garnered more than 52% of the votes. His opposition rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, received nearly 48%, trailing by more than 2 million votes. The country's Supreme Election Council says the remaining unaccounted ballots will not change the results. After he was declared the winner, Erdogan addressed a crowd of his supporters outside the presidential palace in the capital, Ankara. He called on Turks to unite in favor of the country's national goals.
It's time to unite and unify around our national goals and national dreams, leaving aside all discussions and disputes regarding the election period.
Erdogan also said the election was Turkey's most important in the modern era, adding the entire nation was the winner of the election. The runoff was held 2 weeks after none of the candidates could cross the 50% threshold in the first round. Erdogan has now managed to extend his tenure at a time of skyrocketing inflation, mostly blamed on his economic policies.
Turkish citizens headed to the country's first ever runoff on Sunday, May 28, to choose their future president, after none of the three presidential candidates were able to reach the 50% plus one threshold in the first round. Candidates in the runoff were incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and main opposition party leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
We are witnessing a two-round election for the first time.
More than 64 million people were eligible to cast their votes, with 6 million first voters. The turnout was reportedly less than the first round 2 weeks ago, which was 89%. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who came second in the first round with less than 45% of the votes, is mainly supported by the youth, who were promised by him to see more freedoms in the country and enjoy a better economy.
I just voted for Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu using my civil right for the first time because I want to see a change in the country. We want a better economy. As you can see, the cost of living is very high. Therefore, we need someone with a new economic strategy.
Despite gathering 49.5% of the votes and winning the majority in the parliament in the first round, President Erdogan narrowly missed out on an outright victory. However, in round two, the incumbent Erdogan got the support of nationalist candidate Sinan Ogan, who came third in the first round.
I'm a supporter of the nationalist party. I voted for President Erdogan because I want stability in country. We want someone who can protect the country from terrorists, not to be supported by political parties who have terrorism suspicions.
This election is considered Turkey's most important one because it does not only decide who rules the country for the next 5 years, but also defines how the country will be governed, with citizens worried about the economy and migrants worried about their presence in Turkey. But one thing is for sure, the elected president will face lots of challenges, one of which is the worst cost of living crisis in the country's history, with inflation at record highs and the Turkish lira losing its value. And let's not forget the ongoing refugee crisis and the survivors of the devastating earthquake that shocked southern Turkey. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
And congratulatory messages are pouring in for the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan over his election victory. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has passed on his good wishes to Erdogan, saying his victory shows the Turkish people's continued trust in him. Raisi expressed hope that the two countries' bonds of friendship will be strengthened and that their close cooperation will help promote regional peace and stability. Russian President Vladimir Putin also commended Erdogan, whom he called his dear friend. Putin said Erdogan's victory is further evidence that the Turkish people support his efforts to strengthen sovereignty and pursue an independent foreign policy. EU Council President Charles Michel said he looks forward to working with Erdogan to deepen EU-Turkey relations. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, as well as the Hamas resistance movement, hailed Erdogan's victory. France, the US, the UK, Germany, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, and Ukraine, among others, have also congratulated Erdogan. The Israeli regime has carried out yet another airstrike on Syria, this time targeting positions in the capital, Damascus. A number of explosions were heard shortly before midnight local time. The Syrian military says the country's air defenses responded to the attacks using anti-aircraft systems. It says the attacks only caused some material damage. The strikes were the first on Damascus since late March. The last Israeli raid on Syria in early May left 7 people dead in the northwestern city of Aleppo. The Israeli regime routinely carries out airstrikes on Syria. Syrian officials have for a number of times called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its aggression. They say the move is in violation of international law. Dozens of Israeli settlers, heavily guarded by Israeli forces, have broken into Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds and performed rituals there. This is not the first time settlers stormed the mosque, which is revered by Palestinians and other Muslims as an Islamic holy site. Since 2003, the Israeli regime has allowed settlers into the compound almost on a daily basis. Palestinians dismiss the settlers' presence at the mosque as provocative. Tensions have been running high between Palestinians and Israeli settlers over the latter's trespassing on the holy site. Israel captured East al-Quds, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is located, back in 1967. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, Muna Kandil, for more details on the latest Israeli incursion into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
As you were saying, under heavy Israeli military protection, over 160 settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex this morning from the Al-Maghariba Gate. And then Al-Maghariba Gate was completely closed, preventing Palestinian worshippers and Muslims to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex for prayers. According to the endowments of department in Al-Quds, the Islamic endowments of Department of Al-Quds, 40 police officers also were accompanying those 160 settlers as guests, honor guests, raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. 30 students, Jewish students as well, and they unfortunately performed religious rituals inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. According to a statement, 2,230 settlers have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as tourists and not as Jewish settlers. And this is the way it's being used by the Israeli authorities and by the Israelis. They claim that they are tourists. They are not entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex for the prayers. They try to hide the real identity. And however, they when they storm the complex, they perform their rituals. We have to mention that the Israelis since Thursday were, marking one of their Jewish holidays that continued for 2 days, and Thursday and Friday.
For decades, the Hannibal Directive has been one of the most controversial and mysterious procedures in the dark history of the Israeli military. The Hannibal Directive is an order that is used to prevent the capture of Israeli soldiers by enemy forces, even at the cost of the soldier's life. Now, with the development of social media, the directive is becoming more challenging for the regime in Tel Aviv.
The Hannibal Directive, that's the name for one of the most dramatic and controversial murky procedures in the history of the Israeli military. In terms of what it signifies, it's an order that mandates the Israeli army to kill its own troops rather than allowing them to be taken as captives. The order was drafted in mid-1986, just months after the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon. It clearly stated that in case of capture, the main mission becomes rescuing soldiers from the captors at the cost of hitting or wounding the soldiers. Now, nearly four decades after, the measure is becoming challenging for Tel Aviv to conceal its combat-related deaths. According to an article published by online news magazine The Cradle, during the recent five-day Israeli aggression on Gaza, there was renewed controversy over the regime's refusal to acknowledge its human losses in military conflicts with Palestinian resistance forces. The Cradle says Palestinian fighters launched over 1,500 missiles targeting approximately 80 cities and towns. Some of the missiles struck crowded neighborhoods in Ashkelon, Tel Aviv, Ramla, causing significant destruction. Although reports circulated about dozens of deaths and injuries, with eyewitnesses describing scenes of utter devastation, the only published image was the one showing a deceased individual in a settlement near Tel Aviv. Later, Israeli officials admitted the killing of a Jewish settler and a foreign worker, while claiming 74 others were wounded. 1 month prior to the Israeli-Gaza onslaught, Palestinian and Israeli media reported Israel's admission of four officers having been killed in a 2014 operation carried out by Hamas military arm, the Al-Aqsa Brigades. During the operation, the Qassam fighters infiltrated a site near an Israeli settlement in northern Gaza Strip through a 3-kilometer tunnel. Israeli officials initially claimed that the soldiers had neutralized all 12 attackers and did not disclose any casualties among its own ranks.
Well, the Israeli regime has, for decades, refused to acknowledge its human losses from Palestinian resistance operations. This includes losses caused by anti-Israeli operations as well as soldiers killed under the Hannibal Directive, yet the Israeli army maintains the policy of denial or misinformation.
The Israeli regime has a long history of refusing to acknowledge its human losses from Palestinian resistance operations, particularly among its own military personnel. For decades, the regime has been promoting the notion to its adversaries that its soldiers do not die in warfare, but facts on the ground prove otherwise. In November 1982, Palestinian resistance fighter Ahmed Qasir carried out an operation at an Israeli military headquarters in southern Lebanon. Up until today, the regime has refused to admit that the bombing claimed the lives of 141 of its soldiers. Now, decades after the incident, the regime still falsely attributes the explosion to a gas leak or a structural error that led to the building collapse and refuses to acknowledge that despite convincing evidence, it was in fact a suicide bombing that caused the explosion. Ever since that bombing, numerous incidents have happened with Israeli officials maintaining the policy of refusal and misinformation regarding its troop losses. In May 2022, a former Israeli minister disclosed that Officer Barak Sharabi from the Sayeret Matkal unit was killed in an operation in Syria in 1984, contrary to claims by authorities that he died in a car accident. Another one in the year 2021, when Israeli archive disclosure revealed the actual death toll from 1991 Iraqi missile strike on Israel were almost 5 times the officially stated number. Providing such misinformation has even drawn reaction from international rights bodies, with some of them saying official Israeli statistics should be treated with caution. All what it is the fact that the regime in Tel Aviv is very sensitive to acknowledging human losses, so it established a highly disciplined media system completely subject to the army's narrative. Israeli soldiers are said to get used to hearing the phrase, "He completed the mission and returned home safely," a behavior which has become the subject of ridicule for new armed resistance groups, namely the Lion's Den and the Jenin Brigade. They said let the Israeli regime announce its deaths in road accidents, falling from trees and adventures alike. What one would easily differentiate, though, is the cause each side is fighting for, one for the liberation of their land and the other for occupying the land of others.
That brings an end to World News for this hour.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Limelight. The U.S. Republican Party would rather hold hungry American families hostage than tax the wealthy. The GOP, unable to destroy the social safety net through normal legislative processes, has turned to blackmail. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted recently, with negotiations on legislation to raise the debt ceiling reportedly stalled, 66 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, CPC, sent a letter to the president urging him to invoke the 14th Amendment, one clause of which mandates the federal government to pay its bills as an end run around GOP obstructionism. Meanwhile, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, along with high-profile House members such as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have kept up a drumbeat of social media criticism, accusing the GOP of wanting to eviscerate social protections for the poor in order to satiate the tax-cutting demands of the super wealthy. At some point in the next 10 days, if Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's forecasts are accurate, the U.S. stands to run out of money. Actually, to be accurate, there should be air quotes around that phrase, as in, the U.S. stands to run out of money. In reality, the U.S. has been operating in the red for decades, and from the George W. Bush presidency onward, it has made deficit spending a core part of the nation's social compact. Put simply, as a country that likes to spend a lot of cash on everything from missiles to other military equipment, from social security and food stamps to spying, but they don't like raising enough taxes to fully pay the bills. And given the place of immense power and privilege that the U.S. has in the world, to date, they have been remarkably lucky, with markets willing to lend the country trillions of dollars at spectacularly low interest rates. No other country on earth could get away so easily with such irresponsible spending and taxation policies. But that only works if those markets are super confident in the U.S. reliability, that when it owes interest payments on its debt, it will pay with no haggling, no tantrums, no effort to somehow cut a bargain. A loss of market confidence triggered by an entirely manufactured and avoidable political crisis around the Congress raising the debt ceiling is what Yellen really means when she talks about the country running out of cash. For the past several weeks, the White House and the congressional leadership have been involved in a prolonged back and forth mainly aimed at securing concessions from Biden that an unfeebled McCarthy can take to his hardline caucus, the most extreme members of which have a virtual veto power over anything he does. A month ago, the House passed a debt ceiling bill that included the promise of reducing across-the-board spending by 14% over a decade, given it exempted the military, Social Security, and Medicare from cuts. This would, if enacted, result in absolutely sweeping reductions to all other areas of federal spending, slashing education and environmental programs, putting a chainsaw to nutritional aid, eviscerating public health spending, and so on. This bill was nothing more than a political performance, and a bad performance at that, since neither the Democrat-controlled Senate nor the White House would seriously entertain such a measure. Now, a month later, McCarthy's red line in his negotiations is supposedly imposing 20-hour-per-week work requirements on able-bodied recipients of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, commonly known as food stamps, as well as Medicaid and temporary assistance for needy families. Given that most people on SNAP who genuinely can work do already work, and given that many of the low-wage jobs available come with no health benefits and shockingly low pay, these requirements would likely further immiserate people without genuinely encouraging them to secure footholds that would take them up the country's economic ladder. In fact, the proposal is a recycled version of ideas that have circulated within the GOP for 30 years. Republicans proposed a $16.5 billion cut to SNAP in 1995 and a $40 billion cut 18 years later. Under this version of the proposal, able-bodied adults under the age of 56 would have their food stamps cut off after 3 months unless the recipient was working. Some of the most hardline GOP Congress members want that age cap increased to 65. They would be able to re-enroll again only after 3 years have elapsed, and then once more, they would be limited to 3 months of benefits every 3 years. The Congressional Budget Office have estimated that this would result in 275,000 people per month losing access to benefits that rely on. None of this would even begin to make a dent in the country's $31.4 trillion debt. Even the Foundation for Government Accountability, a conservative think tank that wholeheartedly embraces the workfare requirements, estimates it would only result in $149 billion in savings spread out over several years. That may sound like a lot, but in the grand scheme of things, it's financial chicken feet, less than 0.5% of the total amount of money the U.S. now owes to its creditors. For McCarthy to make this a red line in his negotiations over the debt ceiling is the worst kind of grandstanding. It has nothing to do with genuinely tackling the U.S. out-of-whack budget, and everything to do with blackmailing the Biden administration to impose destructive changes to the social safety net that the GOP has been unable to enact through normal legislative processes. If McCarthy succeeds in securing these work requirements and then gives the green light to his caucus to vote in favor of raising the debt ceiling, the United States fiscal imbalance will still continue APIS, and his caucus, which claims to be so fiscally responsible, will still have to vote for another debt ceiling increase months or years down the road. This is, after all, a problem largely created by the GOP's tax-slashing ideology, by major tax cuts under Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and Donald Trump that have disproportionately benefited the wealthy and cost the Treasury tens of trillions of dollars over the last 40 years. Unwilling to consider common sense tax reforms, Republicans are instead holding hungry families hostage to their ideology, and they are doing so in a particularly dangerous manner, threatening the possibility of a U.S. debt default unless they get their way over the coming days. If this game of brinksmanship goes wrong, as it all too easily might, given the hold that burn it all down extremists have over McCarthy's House leadership, the U.S. and, by extension, the global economy will suffer a huge and entirely needless hit. If the U.S. does end up defaulting, the decades in which the country has been able to borrow on the cheap to fund tax cuts for the affluent, bloated military budgets, and a safety net system for the elderly will grind to a sudden halt. None of this will solve the U.S. debt crisis. It will, with higher interest rates and even greater political chaos, simply make it exponentially worse.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Viewpoints. I am Bita, the host of today's episode, and here with me there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Ali and Brother Hassani. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So I'm going to start the episode of today with one of the beautiful quotes from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. من أخذ للمظلوم من الظالم كان معي في الجنة مصاحبا. Whoever takes the right of the oppressed from the oppressor, whether the oppressed is a Muslim or a non-Muslim, will be with me in paradise or heaven. As you know, we see the Palestinian people that are in a condition that they are oppressed. Despite this oppression, they are so powerful that we can take a lot of lessons that we talked about this point in the last episodes. And the point is that we have responsibility here towards the people who are oppressed, whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim. So in this episode, we're going to talk about these responsibilities, the point that you took into account that they have to raise their voice, they have to advertise, and they have to go into social medias and so on. I think, in my opinion, is more related to the responsibility of Islamic Ummah more than be the responsibility of these Palestinian people. So up to here, you mentioned some responsibilities of these Palestinian people, like resistance, or like unity, that are so important for sure. But as you know, we have to all have our hands together to defeat the Israel and the dark side of the story. And so in this part of the episode, I want you to talk about the responsibilities of Islamic Ummah, which I think is as important as the responsibilities of Palestinian people. Yeah. So, yeah, Brother Ali.
Muslim Ummah, Islamic governments have their own duty to support Palestinians, either financially or
spiritually,
or even through in the form of, let's say, equipment that they are in need of.
Yeah.
It's their duty. I mean, they cannot escape from this duty that is on our shoulders.
Yes,
this is Islamic duty that is on their shoulders.
And the least is, I feel like, if verbally, you know, you show your support.
At least this is the least of thing that they can do, right? Palestinians, why should one side of this battle, why should one side of this fight be fully equipped with different arms, different weapons, different models of modern weapons, but the other side should be empty of those weapons? Yeah. So does it bring any responsibility for the Muslim governments, Muslim countries to actually equip their brothers and sisters to at least stand to save their own lives?
Yeah.
So this is the duty to equip them with whatever they are in need of.
Right.
Why should only one or two countries just, I mean, take the burden of this responsibility? Right. Yes, this is one. Second, I want to invite all the Islamic governments first and then Islamic nations second. Again, the same thing that I was advising the Palestinian brothers is, know your enemy. Who is your enemy in this time? In case the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was alive, who was standing in front of the Prophet?
Mm-hmm.
Who was standing in front of the Prophet? I mean, it's quite easy to understand. The one who is actually killing your brothers and sisters in faith, day and night, and you are silent and saying, just watching, and it's as if nothing had happened.
Right.
No. Yeah. No, it's not acceptable. They have to know who their enemy is. How can you digest it that this Islamic country, the other Islamic country, they started normalizing their relations with Israel? Why should Bahrain, why should Turkey, why should, I mean, other countries come to start their relation with Israel? Why should Azerbaijan open its embassy in Israel and the other side? So is it acceptable? Why do you recognize this enemy? I mean, this clear enemy of yours. So even some of the people who are living in these countries were the ones who escaped from their original land, that is, from Palestine sometime. Mm-hmm. So how come that you are giving right to the killer of your, let's say, ancestors?
All right.
Right?
Yeah, all right.
What kind of logic are you following? So I advise the brothers and sisters in Islamic Ummah just to open your eyes and watch it again. Who is your enemy and whom whom you have started your relations again with, to review these things with you. Do you have any responsibility from the Islamic point of view or no? If you have no responsibility, or if you don't believe in Islam or any religion, so that's okay. We have nothing to talk and nothing to tell you. But if you think that you are a duty-bound person, that Islamic values and Islamic rulings are important to you, so you have to support Palestinians from financially, materially, spiritually, in whatever way that you think it's good to do.
Yeah, so Brother Hassanin, do you have anything to add to this point?
So when you talk about the duties of the Islamic Ummah, and as Brother also mentioned, like, first of all, we need to differentiate between the Islamic governments and the Islamic Ummah. So, you know, when we talk about the Islamic government and the Ummah's indifference to the Palestinian cause, like, first, let me talk about the governments. So, you know, the Muslim governments giving any statements or opinions regarding their indifference towards the Palestinian cause, it's completely unacceptable. Because as Brother also mentioned, it's their duty, because, you know, to support their, you know, their brothers and sisters in faith. So their indifference is completely unacceptable. Let me give an example. For example, you know, the three people, like, two of them are best friends, and the some guy, some random guy, the third person comes in and he hits your, and he beats your best friend. And then he comes and he's good with you, he's like shaking hands with you. So now you cannot be indifferentiative over here, right? So, you know, you should show something over here. So he's hitting your brother and it doesn't make any difference to you. So you need to take a stand. You need to stop. You cannot just completely be friends with the enemy of your best friend. Exactly. That's actually hypocrisy. So you need to take a stand over here. And the next thing regarding the indifference of the people, like, you know, we might have discussed this before, that, you know, alhamdulillah, there are many people, like, I'm talking about the people, Islamic Ummah, they support the Palestinian cause and they raise their voices. But there are still many people, as Brother also mentioned, they do not recognize Israel as an enemy. You know, first of all, I guess where this problem comes from, it comes from, you know, they feel like, you know, they are not harming us. So they do not deem them to be as their enemy. They don't see the Ummah as one body. They say, like, you know, okay, I'm living in XYZ country. No one is harming me. I'm living my life prosperously. So I don't have to do anything with the Palestinians being killed in Palestine. So you don't see it as one whole ummah.
But they cannot see the consequences of this harming them, that finally, at the end of the day, they will get back to him.
Exactly. If you look at the situation that way, you will raise your voice, like, you will stand against Israel. Mm-hmm. But if you see that, you know, that consequences might one day reach to you as well.
Definitely. And that's why we suggest that for these brothers and sisters to open your eyes. And your duties, you might say, okay, so someone is indifferent, someone says, okay, it doesn't harm me, and so I don't care. But the others who at least have a sort of morale, that there is a hope of reviving this morale in them, we will tell them anyone based on his capabilities and capacity has a sort of duty to do it with regard to the Israel and with regard to the issue of Palestine. If you are able to pay something, you have to pay. If you are able to write, you need to write. If you are able to speak, you need to speak. If you have, let's say, a chair in your university, this is your duty to do that. So it doesn't mean that everyone should come to the battlefront and just start killing the Israeli enemy. No. We have to enlighten whoever we can, I mean, with every facility that we have at hand, you see? So this is a duty of a Muslim or Islamic Ummah in general.
Thank you. So we got to this point that we have to spread this awareness about Palestinian people and this issue so much, and the people, and this insight that when you do not want to help and involve yourself in this issue, you have to consider this point that maybe tomorrow you are the person who is oppressed, you are the person who is inferior and need the Islamic Ummah help. So we have to consider all these facts together and know that we have to maintain this cautiousness in this world, that knowing your enemy, your friend, is so important to survive. You know, at first, the first step is to survive and then fight against the dark side of the story. So, but one thing which we didn't talk
maybe,
about...
Like before you present your question, like I would like to add one point over here. That not just considering, like, you know, that maybe I might be the next target. So, like, these are one of the factors. This might happen.
Yeah, exactly.
But the main thing, the main idea is, like, you know, supporting the oppressed. It's not like necessarily the Palestinians. So, the you know, Israel is harming or bothering
this
the Palestinians.
This is a higher intention.
Yeah. This is not the main intention. That's just, like, one of the factors of this whole, you know, what do you call it, topic, of this scenario. This is one of the factors. But the main idea is, you know, supporting the oppressed people and, you know, being against the oppressor. That's the main idea.
Yeah, what you mean. Yeah. Thank you, sir, for your point. So, but the one thing which I think we didn't talk about enough is about the resistance, the factors of resistance that should be, should exist here in this battlefield. What are the factors of resistance that Palestinian people should consider as a responsibility?
Well, we can actually get back to this question in this way, that did resistance work or not? I mean, during last, at least last 40, 50 years ago. Did it work or not? If it was, if it not works, so no need to support it anymore. But when it works and when you see that you are limiting the your enemy from expanding its territories to more areas because, you know, they have stopped somewhere because... if I want to give the statistics, now they have taken almost 96% of the original Palestinian land. Mm-hmm. See, if you see that they have stopped, they have been stopped somewhere, so they are not actually adding any more. It means that the resistance worked to some extent. We have seen that resistance work in the time that they have actually attacked the south of Lebanon. We have seen that actually it gives this courage to Palestinians that this Israel that they know with these characteristics and specific and these specs has the power to be broken. I mean, has this ability, has this potentiality to be broken.
Yeah.
So it actually encourages people to stand, and it's quite, it, I think easy to understand that when you stand in front of let's say, if you do not stand in front of a bully, it will he will continue to kill you or to bother you or to violate you. But if you stand in front of him and actually go ahead, it's quite natural that you will see the results. So when they have seen and witnessed that this resistance is showing its results today. So why shouldn't they actually focus on that? It's not only their own duty, but even the Islamic Ummah, I mean, even Muslim countries should come and actually join the resistance line.
So,
once they said that this resistance line has been made, for example, by some certain countries just to add their territories and expand their territories. No, they were all lies that they made just to distort the reality of this resistance line. Now they are saying this was the resistance line that actually defeated Daesh or ISIS in the region. It was the resistance line that weakened Israel. If you see that Israel is in chaos today, it's due to the acts, due to the actions and activities of the resistance line.
And also, brother, the statistics you mentioned about the Israel usurping 97%. Like, if there was no resistance, then this usurpation...
It was 100%.
It was 100%, and it would have been much quicker.
Yeah.
So they took, like, certain amount of time to usurp this amount of land.
Very
it
true.
Would have been much quicker. And additionally, the Palestinian resistance has highlighted the importance of international solidarity.
Mm.
And the need for a collective effort to achieve justice and freedom.
Very true.
So, thank you, both of you, for being here about talking about the responsibilities that we have to take against this issue. I think at last we are all responsible because we are human beings and we have to do something about this point. So thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will. finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Father, to wipe away my tears. That's why I will cry. I feel scared, but I won't show my fears. I keep my head high, deep in my heart. I never have any doubt that Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Limelight. U.S. President Joe Biden's global agenda faces serious challenge as emerging powers and developing countries seek to escape the deadlock created between United States, Russia, and China, and in some cases, exploit the competition between the three world powers to realize their own interests. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia's Sputnik news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Recent Pentagon leaks reveal an array of major developing nations are seeking to sit out the intensifying standoff between the United States and Russia and China. The leaks comprise classified U.S. intelligence assessments which show that such countries as India, Brazil, Pakistan, and Egypt try to straddle allegiances in an era when America is no longer the world's unchallenged superpower. According to the document, President Joe Biden's global agenda faces significant challenges as the influential regional powers try to remain on the sidelines of Washington's strife with Moscow and Beijing, sometimes capitalizing on this rivalry for their own gain. As far as Pakistan is concerned, one of the leaked documents cited the country's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Hina Rabbani Khar, as arguing that Islamabad can no longer try to maintain a middle ground between China and the United States. Hina Rabbani Khar reportedly expressed concern in an internal memo that the instinct to preserve Pakistan's partnership with America may damage Islamabad's real strategic collaboration with Beijing. On India, one more leaked document indicated the country's National Security Advisor, Ajit Kumar Doval, had earlier assured his Russian counterpart, Nikolai Patrushev, of New Delhi's support for Moscow in multilateral venues, also singling out India's reluctance to support the Western-backed United Nations resolution over Ukraine. Neither the White House nor the US Department of Defense, the Pentagon, have commented on this matter. Carnegie Endowment for International Peace scholar Matthias Spector told the US media that emerging powers are recalibrating as China expands new economic and military clout and Russia demonstrates its ability to deflect Western pressure. Matthias Spector added, "It's unclear who will end up in a pole position in 10 years' time, so they need to diversify their risk and hedge their bets." In the U.S. new National Defense Strategy, which was released in late October 2022, along with the country's Nuclear Posture Review and Missile Defense Review, the Biden administration labeled China as a consequential strategic competitor for coming decades, while calling Russia an acute threat. The document claimed China and Russia now pose more dangerous challenges to safety and security at home, even as terrorist threats persist, adding that both countries have deployed space capabilities that could purportedly target the US GPS and other space-based capabilities that support military power and daily civilian life. Speaking to reporters after the strategy's release at the time, America's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin claimed that while Russia can't systemically challenge the United States over the long term, unlike China, it does pose an immediate and sharp threat to our interests and values. As for the classified intelligence documents, they have been leaked on social media sites in the past several weeks, in particular providing intelligence on a spate of sensitive security matters relating to the war in Ukraine, including Ukrainian air defenses, Russian military activities, and US assessments of the standoff. The Pentagon confirmed that the documents appear to contain sensitive and highly classified material, but insisted that at least some have been doctored. The Russian Foreign Ministry in turn suggested that the leaks might be fake and reflect a deliberate attempt to mislead Moscow. The Washington Post has also covered this story and tells us more. According to the intelligence cited from a series of U.S. secrets leaked online via the Discord messaging platform, emerging nations' bid to overcome Washington's confrontation with Moscow and Beijing have put Joe Biden's global agenda at risk. The article stressed that Brazil, Egypt, India, and Pakistan are unwilling to unequivocally support one side or the other, in an era when America is no longer the world's unchallenged superpower. Pakistan has received billions of dollars in U.S. economic and security aid following the 9/11 attacks, but now is heavily reliant on Chinese investment and Chinese loans. In an internal memo titled Pakistan's Difficult Choices, Hina Rabbani Khar, Pakistan's Foreign Minister, stressed that Islamabad should avoid giving the appearance of appeasing the West and said the instinct to preserve Pakistan's partnership with the United States would ultimately sacrifice the full benefits of the country's real strategic partnership with China. Another document, dated 17th of February, describes Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif's consultation with a subordinate on the issue of the anti-Russian resolution of the United Nations General Assembly. During the discussion, one of Shehbaz Sharif's aides stated that support for the resolution would interfere with negotiations with Russia on trade and energy issues, and supporting the Western-backed resolution could jeopardize those ties. The report unveils Pakistan ultimately abstained from voting on this resolution. This is while key US allies in Europe and East Asia have backed Joe Biden's Ukraine campaign and are providing more weapons while ditching Russian energy, but Washington is facing resistance elsewhere. According to the Washington Post report, South Africa, another emerging power that has recently held a military exercise with Russia, has denied a request by the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to arrest Russian President Vladimir Putin if he should visit during a summit this year. And officials there told the U.S. Secretary of State they would not be bullied into making decisions that don't suit them. Also, the Washington Post notes the Central Asian leaders are eager to work with whoever offers the most immediate deliverables, which for now is China. Washington Post says the document did not clarify the countries, but they probably include nations such as Kazakhstan that are seeking to develop new partnerships with emerging powers in energy and trade. In addition, some officials in the Global South, a term used to describe parts of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, are positioning themselves as a diplomatic bridge between the three rivals. The leaked documents preview Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's proposal to stand up a world peace bloc to mediate U.S. and Chinese interests and broker an end to the war in Ukraine. Meanwhile, according to another leaked document, the president of Argentina, Alberto Fernandez, planned to use a renewed alliance of Latin American nations, including Argentina, Mexico, and Brazil, to secure more power in negotiations with the United States, China, and the European Union. As Washington Post had previously reported, the repercussions of U.S. tensions with Russia are particularly acute in Egypt, which receives more than $1 billion a year in aid from Washington, but has deepened its ties with Moscow. Russia is building Egypt's first nuclear power plant and promising to provide it with military hardware. The leaked documents show Egypt attempting to navigate the standoff over Ukraine and parry demand for military aid from both Russia and the United States.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.